Good morning. How are you doing? I don't know what kind of week you've had. I don't know where you've been. I don't know what you've done. But you know, I believe when we open God's Word together as a community of people, He has something for each of us in there. So I'm kind of excited today. It's a really interesting passage we've got to look at. It's quite a lot of it. There's 12 chapters, and it's set in the context of a really exciting series. So the series is titled "Who Are You When No One's Looking?" And across the next 4 weeks, we're going to look at some issues that speak to that. So I think to set the whole thing in context, what we're doing this year as a church is looking through a set of themes: who we are in relation to God, who we are in relation to each other, and who we are in relation to our world. And this four set of services called "Who You Are When Nobody's Looking" or "Who Are You When No One's Looking." Don tends to have it as a statement. I tend to phrase it as a question. But those are two different styles of challenge. It is about how we are with each other, how our individual behaviours, our individual choices, our individual relationship with God makes who we are as a community, forges who we are as a group of people. So, we believe that through His Word and through each other, God guides our relationship with Him. He shapes us as a community, and He shapes who we are with the world. Kind of an Old Testament verse and a New Testament verse to set that up. So the first is from Deuteronomy, and it's, "The Lord will establish you as the holy people, as He promised you in an oath. If you keep the commands of the Lord your God and walk in obedience to Him, then all the peoples on the earth will see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they will fear you." And another drawn from John, Jesus says to His disciples, "Love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this will everyone know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." So you have in both those verses the sense of God setting apart for Himself in the world a community of people who live by a different set of rules, who believe a different thing, and who are in some way His. And this is really a big biblical theme. It's a big theme of the Bible. It's a big thing that happens. God's people are marked as different from the people around Him. And those markers change over time. So it moves from a family, up through a tribe, into a nation, into a kind of international community of believers. The nature of the signs changes too. So you've got a covenant of circumcision, a covenant of law, and then a covenant under Jesus' sacrifice. And as these things change, as God's relationship with His people changes through signs, there are a few constants. And in this series, we wanted to pick out those constants as things that run kind of through the whole of the Bible, through this big picture story, to talk about over the next 4 weeks. So I'm going to be talking this week about integrity and corruption. Dawn is going to take the next 2 weeks and talk about generosity and selfishness, and humility and power. And then finally, Graham's going to look at hospitality and inclusion in the fourth week. So, you know, some nice, light, non-challenging topics coming up. So I've kind of starting off with integrity and corruption. So this quote to kind of ground us. I know none of those words, integrity, corruption, generosity, selfishness, humility, power, hospitality, inclusion, they're not simple words. George is learning to read right at the minute, and none of those words come up in that kind of first phonetic, you know, it's no dog, cat, and rat. They're all kind of difficult words, even for people who speak English as their first language. And many of us as Glaswegians certainly don't speak English as a first language. So here's an attempt to define it. Here's the attempt to define what we mean. Integrity is doing the right thing when you don't have to, when no one else is looking or will ever know, when there will be no congratulations or recognition for having done so. It's from Charles Marshall. Incidentally, it's a really good... My last sermon was about the perils of online living. If you search that quote, you will see it attributed to C.S. Lewis more often than not. But it's from Charles Marshall in his book Shattering the Glass Slipper. A little problem with attribution there. And then I'll try and kind of break it out. I like words. I really like words. I like to know where they come from. I like etymology, the study of where words come from and what they do. So here's the words we're going to be using a lot today. In English, we have integrity and corruption, and then we look to ground them in a biblical setting. So the two Greek words, teleos and anomia, and then the Hebrew words, tamim and hevon. They are kind of wrapped up with the concepts that we're going to be talking about today. But kind of, again, defining words by going back to ancient languages probably isn't very helpful. So two images for you. The first is actually drawn from one of the last sermons I did on James. It's interesting. Don has given me three sermons to do across the last year, and that's great. It's a real privilege. But really, the book of James is about integrity. I talked about how you deal with technology with integrity, and now he's asked me specifically to look at integrity. So either he's got a message for my character, or God wants me to recognize something. So, when we use the word integrity, what do we mean? Well, the image I used at the end of talking about the book of James is one of a house, and a house with lots of different rooms. And Jesus says, I stand at the door of your life and I knock. And I think sometimes we just let him into the hall, we let him into the vestibule, and we don't let him into any of the other rooms of our house. We leave spaces in our life that are cut off from him. And what integrity, what this teleos tamim living is opening up the rest of the spaces in our life to God, living wholeheartedly, living fulsome lives, living lives where there is no space shut off from him. So that's the image on integrity, that trying to ground it in reality. And then this other word, hevon, in the Hebrew meaning corruption. It's not specifically corruption, but it's the word that... It's the word that's used to describe some of the behaviour in the passages we're going to look at. And it kind of means iniquity. It means evilness or error. And the picture is a road that has gone off, has gone crooked. So if you remember, one of the things that John the Baptist does is make the way straight for the coming of the Lord. It's the opposite of that concept. It's a road that's weaving and out of control and goes off with precipices to either side. So it's that feeling of something that is going or has gone wayward. And that's where we're going with corruption. So if you can open your Bibles with me, and please do open your Bibles. We're looking at a story today. We're going back kind of old school, proper Sunday school approach to the Bible, where you read the stories and you understand what they tell you. And I'm kind of excited about that. So starting at chapter 37, we're looking at the story of Joseph, and it's worth talking about where this occurs in the Bible and worth kind of setting up the whole book of Genesis. So Genesis is really the foundation, it's the first book in the Bible, it's the foundation stone for the story of God's people. So lots of the themes I was talking about that we see recurring throughout the Bible that occur again and again and again are set up in Genesis and occur first in Genesis. So Genesis 1 to 11, they start with the tree. They start with the story of the original kind of corruption of the human race. God has made the world perfect. He's made humanity to have a relationship with him. And he's made, and people corrupt that relationship. That's where corruption enters in. And the story of the whole of the book of Genesis is taking those first 11 chapters and beginning to get us towards the story of renewal. So right in the middle, right at the end of chapter 11, at the start of chapter 12, God makes a man called Abraham this promise. I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and whomever curses you, I will curse. And all the people of the earth will be blessed through you. So corruption has come in chapters 1 to 11. And the first part, Genesis 12 through to the end of the book in 50, is the very beginning, is the start of God's story to restore integrity, to restore integrity to his relationship with people and with people's relationship with each other. And he chooses to do that through first an individual, then a family, and then a tribe and a nation. But they come after the end of Genesis. At the very end of Genesis, we have the story of Joseph, which is where we're going to be today. And Joseph ends with 70 people in that community. So it's a family of 70 people covered by that community promise. So having spent ages and ages and ages in preamble, let's get into the word. So things to say about the story and where it lands. We've set it up in Genesis, and there are fully 13 chapters at the end of Genesis applied to this. And Joseph and Joseph's story get more treatment than any other of the big characters in the book of Genesis. And there are some big hitters in there. There's Noah, there's Abraham, there's Isaac, there's Jacob, there's Adam and Eve. You know, all of those big foundational Sunday school stories are in the book of Genesis. And yet the author devotes 13 whole chapters at the end of the book to a really pretty detailed story of Joseph, which is kind of odd because he's sort of a branch line. He's not the whole Old Testament. The whole Old Testament unpacks the line of Jesus, and actually Joseph's family is a bit of a branch line in that. There's 13 chapters here that are effectively the author having a bit of a sidetrack story. We're in a kind of if we're talking about modern TV series, we're in one of these weird kind of filler episodes. You know, maybe the 20th episode in the season where the story writers decide to kind of go off on a bit of a sideline. But there's some really interesting stuff in here, which we're looking to unpack. So it falls right at the end of the book of Genesis, and actually it marks the first fulfillment of that promise that God made to Abraham. It ends with God blessing all the nations of the earth through Abraham's family, and specifically through Joseph's integrity. So I will attempt to keep references to the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical to a minimum, because I'm not sure they help anyone, but it will appear. So let's do a quick overview. So there's the first reference. Way back, many centuries ago, not long after the Bible began. So we start in chapter 37, and I'll read from there in a minute. But the kind of overall picture that we're building towards is... Joseph starts from a difficult home life. Chapter 38 is a weird one, and I won't talk about it very much, but it's important to note that it's in there, and it's a kind of diversion on a diversion, or perhaps back to the main story. Joseph has a very varied life. It's why he makes such good musical fodder. We'll talk about the pool of temptation, we'll talk about the problem of pain, and then we'll talk about what happens when you come into power. So if you'll join me in chapter 37, starting just from verse 1. We all good? We all found it? Great. Jacob, that's Joseph's father, lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks of his brothers, the sons of Bilhah, the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about him. Now Israel, that is Jacob, loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made a richly ornamented robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of corn out in the field, when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down on the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. So there we have it. We have the start of the story. We start from a difficult place, a difficult home life. I think the first thing to say here, and it is actually, it's referencing Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical, we tend to get the wrong idea about Joseph, unfortunately. We kind of think he's a bit of an egotist who's needling his brothers needlessly, who's causing deliberate strife in the home. In the culture of the time, I don't think that interpretation is open to us particularly. So in Genesis, dreams are very important, and in the kind of ancient Near East, dreams are very important, and they are from God. Almost always, they are from God. God tells people things through dreams, and I mean, it doesn't help when you've been portrayed by both Donny Osmond and Jason Donovan on stage that your kind of character looks a bit like an egotist one. But Joseph is not telling these things to his brothers to drive his ego. He is trying to share with them the purpose that God has for their family and the purpose that God has told him he has for his life. So the promise is broadly consistent with the promises that have been building throughout Genesis. God has been telling his family things, telling him who he is and where he is, and that they will be special. And Joseph is here speaking consistent with this. So whilst you can have real sympathy with the brothers, you know, it's absolutely no doubt he's a bit of a telltale. He points out that some of his brothers have not been keeping the flocks in the right manner. He's clearly his father's favourite. He gets bought an ornate robe. His dreams add fuel to the fire. I really like in this chapter that the kind of narrator, tells us, they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. And I think you get this kind of layering up of dislike within the family. You get this kind of this building of tension and this building of real disgust for their brother. And I'm not saying I'm not sympathetic with the brothers on a purely human level, but I don't think the way that the scripture is laid out allows us to say what they did was right. They definitely, Joseph is in the right here, and I think that's important to understand. But it's his integrity that winds up those around him. He is not content, even though shepherding is a lowly job, to do it badly. It is important to him that he does the job he's been given well, and his father kind of recognizes that. Also, these promises he's been given in a dream, it's important to him that his family understand what he thinks God has told them. And there's an integrity in that as well. I think it's worth kind of digging into the difficulty of home life. I think this series is called Who Are You When No One's Watching? And I think the point is at home, someone is always watching, or almost always watching. We find it hard to deal most with those closest to us because we find it so hard to fool them, because they see who we are all the time. They see who we are close up, and they know the real us. Integrity is easier from a distance to some extent, and people that know us best often drives kind of pain and difficulty. I was reading an article this week, and it's kind of related that a third of the young people that leave church cite the hypocrisy of Christians, and in particular a discrepancy between the truths they hear on a Sunday and what they see going on at home as a driving cause for them leaving church. And I understand that, and I reflect on that. I'm not saying we are not to have high standards of behaviour, and we're not to preach high standards of behaviour, but living them too, and being open about when we've fallen down is vital for building that community and building that family. Genesis is very much a book of both family life and family strife. The author, Leo Tolstoy, in his book Anna Karenina, starts, all families are alike. Sorry, all happy families are alike, but each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And it's kind of what makes those stories great, and what Genesis has in it as well. You know, each of the patriarchs have a problem with their immediate family, and problems driven by pain. And I think, as a church, as a group of people, as a group of God's people, we need to be open and engaged with the fact that people come from difficult family spaces, and we need to help them work through that and be a place where people can be real about their family struggles. So, jumping on, we all know what happens. Joseph is sold by his brothers. They initially want to kill him. They initially suggest that they kill him. I should mention, time doesn't allow me to read the entire 13 chapters. If you don't know the story of Joseph, I would seriously encourage you to find a quiet hour and just read the chapters kind of verbatim. They are phenomenal stories, apart from anything else. They are really, it's an engaging piece of the Word of God, and there's stuff in there that I'm going to have to gloss over, I'm going to have to shoot through, because I don't have time. But I guarantee that if you read this story for yourself, you will get something out of it. You will find something in there for you. So, like I said, we all know what happens. Joseph is sold by his brothers. They're first going to kill him, but they decide not to do that. And then they sell him to some Midianite merchants who take him to Egypt. They take his robe, his very fancy robe, his coat, and they splash it with blood. And they send it to his father, or show it to his father, and tell him that he's dead. So Jacob now thinks Joseph's dead. He's very sad about that. And we kind of catch up in verse 36. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, captain of the guard, which kind of sets up the next story, the next part of the story. So we're going to pick that off right at the start of chapter 39. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian, who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who'd taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was in everything Potiphar had, both in the house and the field. So he left in Joseph's care everything he had. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Now, Joseph was well-built and handsome, and after a while his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." But he refused. "With me in charge," he told her, "my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns is entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" And though she spoke with Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even to be with her. One day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. For those keeping score at home, that is the second time a coat has got him into trouble. You could think he would learn from there, but apparently not. So what to say about this? Kind of verses are really ripe with application. I think we all know what it feels like to be tempted, and I think, you know, the Bible is pretty real about what those sources of temptation look like. I think it's interesting in that house there are many things that Joseph could have been tempted by. The passage tells us that he is in charge of everything. He could have embezzled or stolen, as much as he liked, and yet we are not told that's what his temptation was. He could have used the great wealth to escape. He is still a slave, and yet we are not told that's what his temptation was. It's Potiphar's wife, and I think you know, we live in a society where. We live in a society where sexual propriety is not valued particularly. It's not something that our society takes seriously. It's not something that is valued by people in leadership. And I think you know, one of the marks of the community that we have is that. I think what's interesting to me is Genesis predates the law being given by Moses. But the law kind of permeates back, and behaviour within it is judged on the basis of the law. And I think what the point the author is trying to make here is Joseph knew what God's law was, even though it had not been presented. So he first recognises that his own integrity brings a blessing for the household. In verse 8, with me in charge, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns is entrusted to my care. He's recognizing that his relationship with his master is founded on that integrity. The fact that Potiphar trusts him is valuable to him, and it's based on the integrity. His behavior is then rooted in his belief. So he knows what God's law is, even like I was saying before, the law. And then to say that his rejection is countercultural is really important. I think sometimes we make the mistake when we read the Bible of assuming that it was kind of written in Victorian England, that it was kind of written when society was conservative and morals were upright and obvious to all. That's very much not the setting and context of really any of the Old and New Testaments. These are societies where kind of behaviour of all sorts is rampant. The reason I missed out chapter 38, or glossed over chapter 38, called it an interlude for evil in my summary, is because chapter 38 is kind of weird, not weird, is an entirely disturbing switch into what Joseph's older brother Judah is getting up to at the same time. It's worth reading in yourself, but Judah does not share Joseph's sexual moral in particular, and then finally Joseph physically kind of runs away from temptation. I think that's really interesting. He gets himself out. There's too much reading in. There's a bit of reading in to do here. It's not clear whether he's actually tempted or whether he just recognizes that he needs not to be there. It's an interesting story for me personally. I don't know how many of you know me and know my backstory. We've not been here terribly long, but I've had kind of prodigal moments in my own life. So I spent 2 years at university in Cambridge, and it was the desire of my heart to graduate from there. It's what I'd set my life up to do. It's what I'd set my goals on. I'd kind of built my academic future on a degree from that prestigious university, but over the 2 years, I wandered from God. I didn't behave in the way that I knew I should be. I wandered from Him, and my experience is that when your integrity suffers, God will directly intervene in your life to get you out of that circumstance. And Joseph chooses to run here. He chooses to get himself out. But my experience, based on where I've been, is that if you don't make the choice to run, you will find that God intervenes to protect your integrity. And God's intervention is not as simple as running. So the reason I spent 2 years there is because I had to leave the university. I was academically underachieving, and I think it's only one data point, one story. I'm not saying it will happen to you. I'm not saying that's the way God is, But my personal experience is that if you are not taking integrity seriously, God will intervene directly in your life to change that. So jumping ahead to chapter 40, sometime later, I'll fill you in on the story for those who aren't aware. Potiphar's wife lies to Potiphar, gets Joseph sent to jail. He's in jail, but even there, God is still with him. So he becomes the jailer's servant. He gets markedly better care than I think you'd have any right to expect in an Egyptian prison, and he's kind of kept with the big dogs, two of whom are about to enter the story now. So sometime later, the cupbearer and baker of the king of Egypt offended their master, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two officials and put them in the custody of the house of the captain of the guard in the same prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard assigned them to Joseph, and he attended them. After they'd been in custody for some time, each of the two men, the cupbearer and the baker, had a dream the same night, and each dream had a meaning of its own. When Joseph came to them the next morning, he saw they were dejected, so he asked Pharaoh's officials, who were in custody with him in his master's house, "Why are your faces so sad today?" "We both had dreams," they answered, "but there is no one here to interpret them." Then Joseph said to them, "Don't interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams." So from there, two dreams are told, and the cupbearer tells the story of some vines, and Joseph says, "Well, that's a great story. It means in 3 days you will be freed, and you'll be returned to your old position." The baker, excited presumably by his friend's story, tells a dream about baskets of bread and birds attacking them, and Joseph has the sad news that it indicates that he will be executed within 3 days. And these things come to pass. They happen. And then the chapter finishes with this verse. The chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. The cupbearer, Joseph asks on kind of the successful interpretation that he will remember him and free him from prison. And not being remembered is how that chapter finishes. So, I think sometime later, which is how this chapter starts, is probably severely underselling what happened. There's a pretty good chance Joseph has spent as many as 10 years in prison at this time, and although God prospered him, he is in prison on an unjust charge. He would be more than justified feeling really disgruntled at this stage. But in his conversation with the cupbearer, we find him kind of remarkably unchanged by his circumstances, remarkably consistent with who he has been. So first, he recognizes who's in charge. So in verse 8, he says, "Do not dream interpretations belong to God." He still fully recognizes who God is, who his authority is. And he also continues blessing the people around him using his skills. So his skill of administration is used by the prison warder to make everything go well. And his skill of dream interpretation is not withheld from the people that are there. And I think that is a real mark of integrity, of his integrity. So in this situation where he is both unjustly imprisoned, he is still using skills for the fullness of the people around him. I think there's a really interesting chunk of this chapter as well. Joseph is imprisoned on trumped up charges or non-existent charges, and held against his will. He has a really serious issue, but also one of his friends forgets about him. You know, that final verse, "He did not remember Joseph, he forgot about him," really kind of the top to the bottom. The Bible deals with all kinds of pain. It deals with massive injustices and kind of fairly small interpersonal slights. I don't know where you are on the spectrum of that today. I don't know. I don't know if you feel you've been wronged, how you feel you've been wronged, the problem you have. But there's an example in Joseph for that full spectrum. And it's contrasted as well, despite the fact that people have forgotten him. So he's forgotten in jail, and the person he hoped might rescue him has forgotten him. Definitely in the author's mind, there is a suggestion that God has not forgotten him. And that comes to pass. So as we march on through chapter 41, we all know what happens. It starts with when two full years had passed. You definitely get the impression that the author wants to hammer home exactly how long Joseph has been out of the limelight, been stuck in jail. But after another 2 years, we all know what happens. Pharaoh has a set of pretty troubling dreams, and asks for an interpreter. No one can interpret, and the cupbearer finally remembers where Joseph is. He brings him in from the cold. Pharaoh's dreams are interpreted as there being 7 years of real plenty in the land of Egypt, and then 7 years of complete famine. On the basis of this interpretation, Joseph is put over the whole of Egypt. So he is, he literally, his wildest dreams come true. That is precisely what happens in this story. He's in charge of Egypt. He has everything at his hand. He can command legions and armies. He can change the nation's economy. So it's a full rags to riches story. Famine is not just in Egypt. After 7 years, the famine strikes, and after two of those years, Joseph's brothers are also affected. So the land of Canaan, where they come from, is affected by famine, and so they go to Egypt because they hear there's plenty there. There is a real hokey-cokey of a story. There's silver in sacks and silver out of sacks. There's a silver cup in a sack and a silver cup out of a sack. There's some real kind of drama and tension and some interpersonal difficulty. But if you jump ahead with me to chapter 45, we kind of come to the kind of culmination, the denouement of the story. So he's sent his brothers away, and they've come back with Benjamin, his youngest brother. He set Benjamin up by putting some contraband in his sack. He's said to Benjamin, "You will now be my slave because you've stolen from me." And then the most important kind of revelation, his oldest brother Judah says, "I will stand in Benjamin's place. It will kill my father if Benjamin is stuck here. Take me instead." And that marks for Joseph the kind of turnaround. It demonstrates that his brothers have come to some kind of understanding. They threw him down a well 30 years ago or 25 years ago, and they have changed. They are changed men. They understand. So starting in chapter 45, "Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants and cried out, 'Make everyone leave my presence.' So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's household heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Is my father still living?' But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'Come close to me.' When they had done so, he said, 'I am your brother Joseph, the one who you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God had sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there's been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years, there will not be plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh and lord of his entire household and ruler of all Egypt. Now hurry back to my father and say to him, this is what your son Joseph says. God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Don't delay. So here we go. I've called this full power. He has complete control of the land. He knows why he's there, and he's fulfilling his purpose. But we have a kind of inverse challenge now. Who are you when no one's watching becomes who are you when everyone's watching and approves of anything you do? So Joseph has the opposite challenge. He now has armies at his disposal. Revenge at this stage would be just. It would be the just thing to do. The law that comes in Moses is pretty clear about that. It would be the just thing to do. The culture he's part of, the Egyptians, are not a people who let traitors away with stuff. Fury and righteous fury, destroying his brothers would be the right thing to do. But his integrity is shown in mercy here. His hand is stayed. He knows who put him there. He understands. It's much easier to see divine provenance in retrospect. And standing where he is right now, he sees how the actions of his brothers and his actions have brought him to where he is and how they're guided by God. He knows why he's there. And he also keeps an eye on what he's there to do. He understands that God's mission is to save and that getting justice here would not be consistent with that action. My kind of favourite bit of the story is actually after this. It's right at the very end in chapter 50. It is this chunk here. Right at the very end, after his father has died, so there's still lots of back and forth, and his father comes to Egypt and they get a chunk of the land. But after his father has died, his brothers come back to him. They clearly still haven't quite got it. They don't quite understand. So his brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. We are your slaves, they said. They still think that Joseph hasn't killed them just because he feels like he owes his father something. And now that Jacob is out of the way, Joseph would be kind of within his rights to take revenge. But Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. And I think that's the perspective. That's the perspective that Joseph has. That's what fires his integrity, and that's what allows him to live the way he lived and save many lives. He recognizes that God is the one that's in charge of the narrative. So God uses both Joseph's integrity and his brother's corruption to bring about these saving events. And I think that perspective is what allows Joseph to exercise his mercy in the way that he does. So that's an absolute blast through that story. I think I've picked out three things that I'd like you to kind of take away and mull over and meditate on. I think the three things are about, and the one that kind of sits with you most will depend on the season of your life that you are in. So the integrity of Joseph's belief under temptation, the integrity of Joseph's peace in pain, and the integrity of Joseph's mercy in the execution of his power. I don't know which one of those you feel like you're sitting in, maybe some combination of the three, but there's a chunk there to dig into and to meditate on. I think as well the kind of final part here is a bit of a bit of a kind of a kind of summation of the whole thing. So in the Psalms, the psalmist says, "Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path." And I think this verse is fascinating. My experience of my life is that God doesn't really deal in the middle distance. He tells us where we're going. He lights our path. He shows us where we're going to get to. And he gives us a lamp for our feet. He tells us through his word and through the people around us what we should be doing right now. And actually that middle section, that where am I going to in 2 years' time? Where am I going to in 5 years' time? Where am I going to in 10 years' time? God is fairly quiet about. It's not always true. It's not always true. But he tells us where our eternal destiny is, and he tells us what we should be doing right now. And integrity is about having the faith and the belief to do the right thing now and forget about where we're going. Understand where we're going eventually and do the right thing now. And that's what God gives you to deal with.